Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hello, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. My name is Denise Michaud, Chair of the Grownups Forum. We want to say a special thanks to Bernard Osher Foundation for supporting today's Good Lit event. We're going to hear from Caroline Paul and the inspiration for her new book, Tough Broad, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. Caroline Paul has written several books, is a New York Times bestseller, TED Talk presenter, former firefighter, and an extreme adventurer. She'll be sharing the wisdom of her journeys and of the older women that she's written about. And who better to lead this conversation than another adventurer and author? Julia Flynn Seiler is not only a mountain biker, but a competitive rower. She's also a New York Times bestselling author. Her most recent book is The White Devil's Daughter, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. So please give a good welcome to Caroline and Julie.
Thank you, Denise.
Hey, Caroline.
Hi, Julie.
How are you?
We know each other.
Okay, so I just want to start with getting clear on something with you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, we didn't prep for this.
Okay, it's part of the fun. Okay. Come on, let's take some risks.
Okay.
So I was out mountain biking, maybe last spring, out in the headlands, and I look up in the sky, and I see a yellow aircraft. And I look a little closer, and it seems as if a brunette woman is piloting this aircraft. And I thought to myself that might be Caroline. Was that you?
Probably, yes. I do fly over there in my little, it's called a gyrocopter. I actually learned it for the book.
Okay, you learn to pilot a gyrocopter.
Yes.
What's a gyrocopter? And how scary was that?
It's a little experimental plane. It looks a lot like a helicopter, but it flies more like a fixed wing plane, and it's called an experimental, which didn't make my mom very happy. It's very tiny, and it's open cockpit.
I remember the open cockpit part. I was thinking, who'd be crazy enough to be doing that up there? But it was you. That makes me feel a lot better.
I'll wave next time.
So you
will see me if you look up a little yellow, and I have a red flight suit.
Yeah, it's a good look. So your book is called Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age, which is a great, great title and kind of sums it all up. And I was wondering if you could start by just reading a small section from the book.
Yes, I will. I'm going to read from the beginning, actually, and just to give you a sense mostly of the issues that I'm talking about. I'm going to read from the beginning, and I'll set it up by saying I was going to my first interview for Tough Broad, and I was driving to Yosemite National Park, and I got to the toll booth, and turns out with the pandemic, you had to have reservations. So I showed them the reservation, but there was a young ranger. She leans out of the toll booth, and she says, that's not your name on the reservation. It turned out it was the woman I was going to meet for the interview in the valley. And she said, I'm sorry, if your name is not on the reservation, I can't let you bring your car in. I look for a sign that the ranger will relent, but she is young and earnest, and rules are rules. For a moment, there is an awkward silence. Do people walk? I ask. And she looks alarmed and tells me it's 9 miles to the valley. Then I remember my one wheel, fully charged to its 15-mile capacity and resting in the trunk. So I say, half joking and half desperate, well, can I get on my one wheel? I can see by her face that she doesn't understand. And so I add, it's an electric skateboard. And she blinks rapidly, taking in the staid hatchback with the sensible gas mileage, the gray roots of my hair, the thin veil of cat dander that may be rising from my shirt, and the 1963 birth date on my ID. She repeats, electric skateboard? As if giving me time to tell her I'm not serious, but I just nod and she pulls her head back in the booth and then reappears moments later and says, sure, an electric skateboard is allowed. Okay, I'll be back, I say, and I watch her go momentarily still, as if already lost in the future of what she will compose on her social media feed. LOL, old lady on skateboard? I don't hold this against her. When I was her age, I was exactly the same. dumping everyone over 50 unceremoniously into a box labeled old, subdividing that further into just a few categories, limited to adjectives like frail, senile, or boring, not to mention the big one, dying. Even from my callow know-it-all perspective, everyone over 50 was on the downhill slide to imminent death. So I don't feel resentful. I feel delighted and even a little bit sorry for my young ranger, who doesn't realize that soon enough she will be where I am. For now, though, she is still certain that the world works in a particular way and that this is some sort of misunderstanding. She pins the politeness back on her face and waves me around in a U-turn. I park my car a quarter mile down the mountain. I put on my wrist guards and my helmet and my fanny pack because I may be a skateboarder, but I am still 57 years old and I believe in safety first and quick access to chapstick. So then I have some lyrical passages about going back on my one wheel up, back up to the ranger station, where they are actually kind of scared of me as I approach them. They think I'm going to run into them. And I don't. And then they ask me a lot of questions. They're curious about the one wheel. And so then I'll skip to the end here. As I accept a map that has been proffered and answer a few wide-eyed questions about the one wheel, I can tell I have upended expectations. Yet the young rangers have also deemed me harmless, a far outlier on an otherwise neatly plotted bell curve, a one-time zoological curiosity of sorts. But here's what I haven't told them. The friend whose name is on my reservation, who I'm meeting, is also in her 50s. And she would also give them pause. But much, much more pause. She is a base jumper. Someone who habitually hucks herself from buildings, antennas, spans, and earth. That's the B-A-S-E. And then she dons a parachute, then habitually hucks herself from buildings, antennas, spans, and earth. And tomorrow at dawn, it will be earth, specifically the earth on the rim of Yosemite's fabled wall, El Capitan. This is, of course, illegal. There is even a Yosemite Park jail for those caught doing it, and two for those like myself who serve as accessories to their crimes. But right now, to the earnest milling rangers, I am the antithesis of a future felon. I am an older white woman with a cockamamie hobby, and it is confirmed again that the reservation is needed for my car, not the human, and I am free to continue on my skateboard. I am sent off with genuine smiles and small shakes of the head, and then the young rangers turn back to their duties, naturally assuming that there will be no more surprises, that I am otherwise just another gal with a bird list and a picnic, meeting a friend for a gawp around the valley. If they hear from me again, they are sure, it will be because my friend stopped her sedan in the middle of the road and traffic piled up behind us. That's the kind of ridiculous thing those older women do when they spot something flying in the wild, the young rangers have been told. They have no inkling that what might be flying in the wild is actually one of these older women. And then this is my base jumper in the book, and she's actually here, so I want to say hi to Sean. I want to say about Sean that every time I went on, I didn't actually think that this adventure could be included in the book, because base jumping is considered one of the most dangerous things in the world, sports in the world. But let me, for those of you who don't know, she's also a personal trainer. Those of you who don't know what base jumping actually is, that's actually Sean skydiving, not base jumping. So I'm just going to show you something. I know.
All right, here we go. Have fun. We'll see you in a minute.
That's her
Three,
husband.
3, 2, 1. Fucking sick.
Dude, she always sticks it.
Those are her fans in the background.
Sean, will you stand up
for a minute? You guys should talk to Sean afterwards, please. She's amazing in so many ways.
Well, her story is incredible, and you tell it so well. In general, what inspired you to write this book, Caroline?
Well, I was 55, so I'm 60 now. I was 55, and I was, you know, on my surfboard surfing or on my skateboard or flying experimental planes, and I just didn't see women my age. I saw men my age and men older, but I didn't see any women my age. And I started to wonder about my own aging journey. and fulfilling aging for me. And so this book is kind of a quest to figure out. I mean, part of me really did think, oh, maybe outdoor adventure is not something we should be doing as we age. Frankly, I mean, the messaging that women get as we age is pretty toxic. And subliminally, we're kind of told on so many levels that, you know, as we age, we're going to get very frail. We have to watch out for our bones. Definitely a cognitive decline. And frankly, that we're boring. I mean, most women I know, first of all, my friends were so disheartened about their own aging. And I heard often women say, I feel invisible. I feel I'm culturally irrelevant. And we don't see ourselves in the media, in the, you know, dating apps. And men still do. And I don't know the messaging for men. And I have to say that this book is very, outdoor adventure is good for everybody, first of all, at any age. And it's relevant for men too. But this one aspect was why I wrote the book for women, which is that why weren't I seeing women out there? And I got, and I started to realize that it was the messaging. And the messaging itself was holding us back from something that's so important.
Well, and I think it's so important too that you had recently written a spectacular book called Gutsy Girls, which is all about bravery. And so there was kind of a natural evolution in a way to look at what does bravery mean for women entering their 60s and 70s and 80s?
Yeah, the Gutsy Girl is about looking at why we parent girls to be fearful and boys to be brave. And I started to realize that the reason we do it is because we, well, for many reasons, but I think the one reason is because we think being fearful will protect girls. If they're scared, they won't walk down that dark alley. They won't talk to that stranger. But in fact, the opposite is true because you start to, you don't gain self-confidence. You don't practice risk assessment. You don't practice decision-making on your own. I mean, there's so many reasons and I enumerate them constantly in talks and stuff. But so I was very clear that we need to teach girls bravery and they need to start practicing it now. And people wanted me to write Gutsy Girl for women very soon. And I realized I don't have anything that, I mean, at the time I thought that I didn't have much to say to women for a bunch of reasons. I was, you know, white, privileged, queer, no kids, you know, just my life was very particular. So what would I say to 30, 40, 50-year-old women? But then when I was 55, I was like, well, hold it. I have questions about my own aging and I want to go find out. So this book is a quest.
Yeah. Quest books are always the best too, aren't they? And it's so much fun to follow her adventures and all of the incredible people you met. And I was hoping we could walk through some of the, I don't know.
Sean is gone. Sean.
Bye, Sean. Sean survived, as you can tell. She's still.
Oh, well, I do want to say one thing about Sean. Can I go back here for a sec? Is that Sean is a personal trainer. And when I talked to her, she told me something that really stuck with me, which is that, you know, a lot of your clients are over 40, over 50, and they come to you saying they want to, well, probably saying they want to be fit, but really what they mean is they want to lose weight. I think that's, you know, as an American woman. And what you told me is that what you realized is that there was something else missing from their lives besides fitness. And it was that sense of adventure, that exploratory feeling, and that you really saw your clients blossom when they went on trails, kayaks, you know, in the ocean. And so that fitness became really holistic and that women really were looking for adventure. And you were my first interview, and I had a sense that women weren't looking for adventure. And I was like, you guys have to get out here. Where's your adventurous spirit? Well, it turns out we have an adventurous spirit, but there's so many reasons why that's blocked from us. And the biggest reason, again, is the mindset, which brings me wonderfully to Louise Holy, who is 80, and I went scuba diving with her. And the reason, because of the book, I wrote the book, I started planning the book in January of 2020, and I was kind of just going to do it like metaphorically what Sean did. I was going to throw myself off a cliff into like the arms of like women who were older and let them tell me all about aging. And then I'd figure out the book later. But the pandemic hit and nobody wanted to, could talk to me. So I actually ended up doing a lot of research on fulfilling aging. And that's where I started to realize this is a book about fulfilling aging and how outdoor adventure fits into that so incredibly powerfully. And what I found initially, because I was interested in the mindset, the messages we get, sorry, is that our mindset is so important. And the science is kind of boggling about it and really set me back on my heels that I didn't know this. But it turns out that research shows that how we look at our own aging predicts how well we age. So here we have all this messaging telling women already that aging is terrible. So we think aging is going to be terrible. So therefore it is terrible. Because the science shows that if you have a negative view about your own aging, you will have a cardiac event earlier. You will have cognitive decline earlier. If you have a positive view of your own aging, you will be healthier, happier. And even if you have, for instance, as a subset, even if you have that Alzheimer's gene, AOPA4, you have a much less chance of turning that gene on if you have a positive view about your own aging and you live 7 years longer. So it seemed really urgent that this get out, that you have to have a positive view on aging. But then it was like, well, how do you get that positive view on aging in the face of this?
Well, I think role models are important.
Seeing
other people do it. So tell us about this amazing swimmer.
So it's Louise Holy was 80 and she was a scuba diver and she has about 600 dives under her belt. And I was terrified to go dive with her. Even though I had been a diver with the San Francisco Fire Department, I felt like the diving that she did was just and I hadn't dove for 20 years. But I kept asking her, we went to Monterey, which is a difficult place to dive. And I kept asking her all these questions about how she felt about her aging now and how she felt about her aging then. And she kept looking at me really befuddled. And basically, she had taken the aging factor out of her lifestyle. And I think that really, she became like, oh, okay, that's why mindset is so important. She wasn't actually somebody who embraced the positive mindset, but I realized she just did not have that mindset. She had not allowed or she had somehow pushed away all that messaging. Possibly, I mean, because she was inured to it because she was kind of this complete badass in the outdoors. So none of it made any sense to her.
So all of these scuba dives, she's in her 80s, and does she have fear or did she have to overcome fear to keep doing it?
I mean, here's the thing. People ask me a lot about fear when it comes to outdoor adventure, and it's the reason why they don't go outside. And I'm not even talking about adventure that has to be base jumping or, scuba diving. I'm talking about even just getting outside. And what I say to that is, yes, fear is a part of everybody's experience, I think. First of all, in life, but definitely outside. But when I prescribe the outdoors and say it's so good for us, people are like, it's outside my comfort zone. And I say, oh, well, but you'll take a pill that a doctor offers you for your ill health, despite the long string of side effects we all know about. Consider fear a side effect. And it leads to this incredibly, amazing experiences outside.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I had kind of a transformative experience at the beginning of COVID, and my husband and younger son bought me a mountain bike. And all of a sudden, we're pretty isolated. I started exploring my hometown and the base of Mount Tam by myself. I felt like a 10-year-old because there's nobody around. It was this unbelievable feeling of awe. There was a mixture of fear for me, but I kept on getting fitter and fitter and was fantastic and made a few friends. I see one of my mountain biking friends here. And anyways, so I hear.
Well, to jump off that, like as women, especially, well, adults in general, we do not embrace play in our lives and feeling like a 10-year-old because we think it's sort of, we're too serious for that. We don't have time for that. But it turns out play is really important. Mm-hmm. So when I went and interviewed a bunch of boogie boarders in San Diego, I'm a surfer, not a good surfer, but I'm still a surfer who's worked really hard at it. So I calmed down on boogie boarding, I will tell you. Not proud to say that, but I was like, oh, boogie boarding. Well, I went because I thought it would be a way to look at how we could adapt our outdoor activity and do like a simple, fun thing. Even the boogie boarders themselves said, oh no, you don't have to know anything. You don't even have to be fit to do this. They were really funny. But it was a group called the Wave Chasers, and they're a bunch of 60 to 80 year olds. And as with everything, I went with a particular idea of where that outdoor adventure would fit into fulfilling aging. And as usual, I was totally, you know, learned something new. So in this particular case, I was like, oh, boogie boarding, it's so easy. But, you know, most people of any physical ability could do it. What really instead came out to me was the very easiness, the lack of skill is what is the beauty of it, because it allowed these women to have what I would call unruly fun, which is so unusual for women.
Really fun. I like that.
Yeah. It's just to be a
barrier to entry is to use the business term, and just fun. Just goofing around.
Yeah.
Yeah. It, yeah. Again, I first boogie boarded 10 years old at Stinson Beach. And so my sister and I, after reading your book, we're joining a boogie boarding team.
No, I mean, I have a newfound, there's a lot of research on play and we need to bring it back into our lives. It's a way to bond with other people. There's lots kind of play. Yeah. Yeah, it was intriguing.
Let's look at a few of the other.
All right. I don't know who's next. There's Louise still.
Hi, Louise.
Okay. This is Dot. Dot is 93 here. And I went because, you know, I had what I considered the correct definition of adventure, which was it kind of had to be high octane, sometimes almost kill you.
Caroline.
I know. And, okay. But I did have an understanding that getting outside was also important. So I wanted to make this book accessible to everybody. So I was going to dial it back, kind of like boogie board. I was so schooled during this book. Like I would swagger in with this idea and just be completely, you know, turned around afterwards and humbled. And Dot was one of the people that humbled me, because she first wanted to take me on a 5-mile hike up a mountain. And I actually have some injuries that I cannot do that. And so I had to tell a 93-year-old that I wouldn't be able to keep up with her. And she was really, I'm going to use the word because it was true. She was disdainful of me. And, but she said that I told her I had injuries, and she said, oh, okay, well, I used to not be empathetic about injuries, but I recently had my first injury at 90. So I understand. She kind of patted me on the head. Anyway, we went on a walk. And the walk was eye-opening to me, actually. Because again, I didn't think of walking as adventure. But it turned out that with the way Dot walks with, first of all, she goes wherever sort of her whim takes her. She wants to go look at a leaf. She wants to go look at an apple. We walked with a sort of meditation almost. It was like a focus. But what also interested me was how she was so sharp and so so fit. And it turned out that for this chapter, I did a lot of research on the medicinal effects of simply being outside. And the research is eye-opening. So it's great to go to a gym. Mm-hmm. Everyone should go to the gym if you want. But being outside for your activity is so much better for you in terms of well-being. So the chemicals of trees lowers your inflammatory markers. Birdsong has this soothing effect on your brain. And as does the sort of rounded architecture of nature, with sort of the horizon lines that are nothing, there are no sharp edges like the urban architecture, and the fractal nature of the outdoors sort of, and if there's a scientist in here, please help me with this, but the way our eyes are structured means that we can take in nature in such a way that there isn't as much noise, that will, you know, make our brain tired. And they've shown that after a walk outside, you test better cognitively and on memory because your brain doesn't do so much busy work. So in so many ways, the outdoors is vital for you. So
there's a rowing friend here. We were in boats this morning at 6 a.m. as the sun's coming up on the bay, and the bird song in the spring was so profound. It was a profound experience. So I'm hearing what you're saying, Caroline. It's beautiful.
It is.
Yeah.
When you walked with her, where did you walk?
We were in Ashland, Oregon, so it was the suburbs, but she cut across everybody's lawn. I thought we were going to die, honestly. And, but she, as I write in there, like, yeah, it was, she's 93, so nobody was going to shoot us, but I was unsure. But the way she walked, we really concentrated on the nature aspect, even though we were in the suburbs. I was interested in the adaptability again of getting outside. So it's funny. These are all front loaded to make me look really stupid. I want to say, because I went bird watching too.
Say that, Carol.
Well, I went bird watching with the belief that bird watching was also boring. And, but I went because I wanted to see how, no matter what our limitation is, we can get outside, because the outdoors is for all of us. And I like to talk about that a little bit at length, but for sure, our physical limitations is one of the reasons why people say they don't get outside. So Virginia Rose is in a wheelchair. She's been in a wheelchair since she was 14 because of a riding accident. And she found birding at 40. And she realized there was, kind of like me on my surfboard, she realized nobody out here who is in wheelchair. So she started a nonprofit called Birdability. And she brings people with disabilities outside. And I went with her thinking that this was not going to be an adventure, but it would be important to write about. And what I realized was that it had all the rhythms of an adventure when you go bird watching. So there was the quest to find a bird that you were looking for. There was the exhilaration, the anticipation when you heard it, but you didn't see it. There was the exhilaration when you saw it. And then there was the boredom, as you're, you know, and there was the physical vitality of adventure. We were outside and we ended up, I walked, she wheeled, and the other people wheeled or walked, depending, 6 miles. It was a bird-a-thon, which I guess there's different birding things. And so what I realized is adventure is not, when you say I want outdoor adventure because it is so important for us on a mental, emotional, and physical level, that it's your adventure. It's about what it makes you feel like, not about the specifics. So don't go base jumping, you know, don't go flying a gyrocopter, go bird watching, because it gives you the exhilaration, the exploration, the novelty, the purpose. Can I just back up? Because I know I haven't covered this. Is when I did my research, what I found out is there's really like 5 really important things we need to keep in our lives as we age. We need to keep them in our lives all the time, but they tend to fall away as we age. So that would be purpose, novelty, community, health. And then I sort of cobbled these together, but they're obvious. But I added the last one, which is the positive mindset about our own aging. So those 5. And what I went with to each adventure, seeing how it would fit in, they usually covered all of them for one. But I would sort of emphasize which one it really sort of represented.
I love this example because it does show that even people who have limitations in some way can still have outdoor adventures.
Yeah.
That's great. Who's our next? Uh-oh.
So Cynthia, so...
Can I just say, this part of your book terrified me. Is that a picture of you?
No, that's not me.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted them to... They put me on the cover, which I was really upset about. I wanted them to put Cynthia. This is Cynthia Hicks. Someone sent me a video of Cynthia, and... It was basically of that biplane flying, and then suddenly she starts getting up on the wing. And so I knew I had to call her first.
So why don't you explain wing walk?
Oh, wing walk. Okay.
I'm not sure everybody knows.
I know.
Maybe it's obvious.
So, yeah. So it's from the 1920s when planes were fairly new and biplanes would go around to small towns and do these aerobatic shows. They called it barnstorming. They call it barnstorming because they would actually go through a barn. So one of the other things they did is they had wing walkers, which meant that someone would be climb up on a wing and do tricks. And they would actually do things like transfer in midair from plane to plane. Or some the other one is they'd a moving car and a low-flying plane, and the person would get up on the wing, often a woman, by the way. And so they would do these tricks around the country. And then, of course, they had too many accidents. So then, boop, no more of that. So wing walking went out of style. And there's only one place in the country that does it. You're not really a, you don't really become a wing walker. You just wing walk once. It's like skydiving for a lot of people. So Cynthia did this and I watched it and I called her. And I was interested in how a one-time adventure could really help you. Because I had seen this with people do one thing. My mother in particular had gone skydiving at 52 and it had changed her. She had had a sense of herself as someone who was not brave. She was in a moment in her life where she was not doing well with her boyfriend at the time. And it was kind of a what the heck moment where she decided to go skydiving. She visited my twin sister. My twin was learning, is doing actual skydiving, not just one time. And my mom said, maybe we'll do this. And it 2 minutes in the air changed her.
How did it change your character?
Well, it did what I'm so interested in. It upended her own expectations of herself. So she had this image of herself as being someone who wasn't brave. And then she did this, and now you can't say that anymore. She told me, I asked her, why did it change you? And she said, well, because now I had done a brave thing. She wouldn't say she was brave. She said, I had done a brave thing. But that led to all these other changes in her life. And I credit my mom with the reason I am affected by the subliminal messaging about aging as a woman, but I am also inured to it because I saw my own mom blossom as she aged in ways that were made me realize, oh no, older age is a time of exploration and exhilaration.
Well, and you wrote that wonderful essay in the New York Times, How My Mom Got a Bike and It Changed Her Life, or whatever the title was. It was really touching.
Thank you. My editor, Joanna Pearlstein, is here. Oh, thank you, Joanna. She helped me.
Joanna.
Yeah, she has. So I want to just say about Cynthia. So Cynthia said to me on the phone, Caroline, you wouldn't believe the courage you feel when you first get up on that wing. And I thought, God, now I'm going to have to go write about this. I'm going to have to go wing walk because I do want to know about this courage. I think we need courage as we age. And so, but I wasn't psyched about it because I'm a pilot and I think getting out of a perfectly good cockpit is
not a good idea.
No, I was I was really surly about it. And I was reluctant pretty much the whole time. I went to this place in Washington. You learn for a day. All they do is teach you these moves on how to, on the ground, how to do it. But you're going to be doing it at 3,000 feet. And I asked the instructor, Marilyn Mason, who was 50, and she actually was a wing walker because she did wing walking more than once. She did it for fun. She said, when I feel like it. Her husband flies the plane. And I asked her, well, hold it. What is it like at 3,000 feet? It's all fine and good to do this here. And she said, you know, don't worry about it. Your muscle memory will take over. And she was right. All we did was these six moves, asked no questions, just kept doing these moves over and over. And, oh, the other thing is that we had this, there's a lanyard? We're tied to the plane.
You can see it.
Yeah. But they never told us what would happen if we actually fell. Like, if we fell, it occurred to me at one point, maybe later, that we'd be dangling under the plane. Like, how did you land a plane with me dangling under it? But they said no one has ever fallen. So I go, and so then I get, it's my turn to go up. And at 3,000 feet, the wing waggles. And Cynthia had told me, you have to get up really fast. Those who hesitate might not actually do it. So I get up really fast. It's kind of I get tangled. It's not wing walking, by the way. It's crawling and wings slithering, I think I describe it.
Not quite as dignified as
it's not. It is not. No. And I get up and I attach myself to the King Post. And I'm still not very happy about this, but I'm doing it for the book. I'm a writer. And the pilot starts to do loops and hammerheads.
And he hadn't told you ahead of time he was going to do that.
Oh, no, no. I knew.
Oh, you knew.
Oh, no. Okay. I'm not good if I didn't know.
That's better for terrible. The book. Better for the book.
Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. No, I knew. I had seen the Cynthia's video, and they told us to really cinch it tight. They said it doesn't feel good loose if you're upside down. And I was like, no, it does not. And so we're all like this. He begins to do loops, hammerheads, and barrel roll. So that's a loop. This is a barrel roll. Anyway, you get the idea. I went from being really reluctant to being ecstatic. And
to be alive.
And so that's what Cynthia said. At one point you can see she's in her video that she's saying something. I said, what were you saying? She said, thank you, God, for me being alive, or some version of that. She was, by the way, the most grateful person I've ever met. So full of gratitude and a very much an outdoors person. So, So I was so intrigued by what I had been feeling up there when they did this sort of mind-blowing. Like,
okay, I just have to interrupt you because I'm so enjoying the looks on people's faces. I'm seeing like, your descriptions are quite vivid. Visceral.
Oh.
Keep going.
Well, so I can't even really remember how it went. I mean, I did remember, but you can see how I write it. It's kind of in plosives. It's like very staccato because it's nothing your brain has ever done before. If you're a usual person, maybe you, Sean, you wouldn't have been as. But even for me, I'm a pilot. I don't do loops and yeah. So I got to on the ground and I thought, okay, so I know what adrenaline is, and yes, there was adrenaline, but there was something else there, and I did research on this because I was so intrigued about what I had felt up there, and what I realized I had felt was awe. And awe, it turns out, first of all, there's a lot of books out about it now, but at the time I had never, ever associated it with my outdoor adventures. In fact, as I was older, I was realizing that I wasn't really as much into adrenaline anymore. And I started to worry about that. Like, am I getting old? Is it the pandemic? But I realized that what I was getting out of and what I was seeking when I flew, when I surfed, was awe. But I didn't have a name to it, but now I did. And I looked into it, and awe is, first of all, really good for us. It is the feeling that you get in the presence of something bigger than you and mysterious. That's kind of the definition. I think that's pretty, it's associated with religion. And it is considered by scientists to be a reset button for your brain, because I think what it does is kind of offlines your neural system. Because when you're in awe, it's often because you can't really quite place it in words. Yeah, it just kind of discombobulates you in a way that opens you up. And so awe, turns out you don't have to wing walk to access awe.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank God. They did a study here, and I write about it in the book.
Bird watching is fine.
No, bird watching. After I did wing walking, I look back on a lot of the adventures I'd done. I was really, oh, that was awe. Like when I was with Dot, and she was like, look at this leaf. That's awe. And so, in fact, there's researchers here in San Francisco at UCSF Memory and Aging Institute. I think that's the right name, did a study where they asked people between the ages of 60 and 80 to go on a walk. And one of the few instructions was look at everything with childlike wonder. And they called them awe walks. And then they sent a control group out to walk like we normally walk, which is looking at our phones and worrying about
listening to podcasts.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe turn them off.
And they tracked people over 8 weeks, and they measured their physiology, and they found that their inflammatory markers, which is a really key sign of health or ill health, went way down. The all walkers also said that they felt much less anxiety and depression, And here's the interesting one. They felt more gratitude and compassion. And they studied this actually by also some other people have studied this. They put people in awe situations, like in the Redwoods or in the Grand Canyon. And they had one weird study that I talk about in the book where they had a stranger drop a pen. And the people who had experienced awe were way more likely to pick up that pen and give it back to the stranger. Mm-hmm. So there's this sense. So because this makes sense if you think about it, because awe is about it's about interconnectedness in some way. You see your place, your real place in the world. So here's the thing. We live in a world of anti-awe devices. This is another thing that they said. Yeah, we're all phones, which narrows your focus, not big and out there. And it gives you this false sense of power and control. So, but awe is the exact opposite. No power and control. Yeah. And you're small. And they call it a small self perspective. And it's not bad. It's right. We are small.
Yeah.
And so the other thing, this is really cool. Sorry, I'm so enthusiastic about this study. They said, almost as an afterthought, hey, can you guys take selfies of yourselves? And they had a selfie for each walk. And they saw that these selfies changed over this 8 weeks. So in the beginning, the selfie was like normal, like the face in the middle, all big. And then as the weeks went on, they saw that the face of the person receded. This is all unconscious. And the background got bigger. Mm-hmm. So they were sort of the metaphor for, they called it the small self. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a metaphor for awe itself. Like you see yourself in the bigger world.
I had an experience on a sailing boat in the Arctic, and one of the most profound Ooh. Moments was going out at night in a zodiac, and the stars and the icebergs floating around us, and it was so awe-inspiring.
Yep.
I mean, it changed the way I think about the world, certainly.
Yep.
Of course, we were completely disconnected. What did you call them? The awe-sucking devices?
Right, that, yeah, that's...
No Wi-Fi, so...
Holy, did we do? Yeah, we did that. So awe, you guys.
Yeah.
I wanted to say I went orienteering, which is an odd thing, but it's a really important. I was very interested in orienteering because I was looking for, I was concerned about memory because that's something that we are often think we're going to lose as we age. And what turns out that memory and navigation are in the same part of your brain. So if you navigate, you will have a better memory. Turns out we don't navigate anymore because with GPS and...
I see a lot of people nodding.
This is actually, if anybody out here does this kind of research, I would love this research to be beefed up because I didn't find a lot of research on how GPS is hurting us this way in terms of memory. But they've done studies where they've asked older people to navigate using VR. And afterwards, they showed their memory was just statistically significantly way better. So we need to keep navigating. If you know anything about memory championships, the way people often learn big chunks of information is they create a home or a house or what they call a palace, a memory palace, in their head, and they walk through it in their mind because they're navigating through. So that, let's say you take your childhood home and you remember it, and then you put, if you're trying to remember, let's say pi to the 10 millionth, you take each number and you put them in specific parts of that house in order, and you walk that order, and you, in that way, you can remember vast amounts of information. When someone first told me about a memory palace, I was like, hold it, you got to remember numbers and your house? That sounds like a lot. But in fact, it makes you remember better. So I wanted to find somebody. So the outdoors, we need to navigate. We need to walk in. So I wanted to find somebody who used a map and compass. And I went and I found an orienteer because the very sport of orienteering is the use of map and compass. You want to finish a race course, but you need to check in along the way with all these checkpoints that you find on your map.
So Caroline,
she Penny's 72 and she's actually one of the few, like, she's super champion. She is a champion runner.
So I take it you guys didn't get lost.
No.
Okay, just checking. So what was the most challenging part of this book? You were on a quest. Things always don't go exactly the way you expect them. Was there any surprise? Was there any big challenge for you?
I mean, besides becoming more humble about my definition of adventure, which was a big one, I would say that my biggest challenge was writing about my own mom.
I love that chapter. Will you explain how you wrote about your mom, which was at the end of the book?
Yeah, you know, one of the most rewarding parts has been actually, you know, going on. I actually did a talk two nights ago at my mom's hometown.
Oh.
Yeah. And so I got to, and my twin sister interviewed me and my brother took photos. So it was like.
Did your mom get a standing ovation?
Yeah, pretty much. There was little tears. So my mom at 62 began to, this is what I wrote about, Joanna helped me, in the New York Times, but she had been blossoming in her older age and I had seen that. But, you know, you're a kid, so you don't really give her that much. You don't really put it together. You don't want to openly admire her. But at 62, she had split with her boyfriend of 20 years and moved to a totally new town where she knew nobody. And she thought, she heard of a biking group made up of 60, 70, and 80-year-olds. And she thought, well, I mean, I have a bike. It was one of those super heavy ones with the high handlebars. It might even have had a banana seat. I don't know.
Yeah, I know.
But she thought, I'll join that, really just to kind of get a footing and forget about her sadness. And she fell in love with cycling. And we saw, as her kids, we saw her really blossom. It gave her all those, we didn't know at the time, it was giving her all those pillars of fulfilling aging, community. She had this new community. She's not a very social person. So biking was perfect. So no small talk. She said, and if I didn't like someone, I can just bike away. And it gave her purpose because she would plan rides and it definitely physical vitality. And it basically, again, it upended everything she thought of herself without being like, I'm going to sit you down and these are the things you have to overcome. No, she just went out on her bike. And it just disproved the messaging that she believed herself and that everybody was telling her. And she had such a fun life. And I really wanted to write about that. And I did. And I'm glad, but I was really sweating.
Oh, is she still biking?
She has Parkinson's.
Oh.
She got it at 80. And she does no longer bike. And it was cool because when I did that op-ed, Joanna, you know this, I got so many letters from people who were cyclists who were giving me advice on how she could get back on the bike, which was great. And there were ways, but at the time, I think it was just too much when she had to give it up. I liken it to kind of when you lose your boyfriend or girlfriend and you swear off love forever. And she kind of did that with biking. There were options, but she still exercises because exercising is really important for Parkinson's.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think we should turn to some questions. We've got time for it.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
Is there an adventure that's looming that you can't wait to try, you haven't tried? Because I'm ready to pitch to you wing foiling.
I actually do. So I'm one of those people who is kind of a jack of all trades. I'm not trying to be humble here. I'm really not. I am not trying to be coy. I'm not really good at anything. I just do them and enjoy them. And I find I enjoy things way more now. So I'm not actually trying to do anything new. I'm trying to get more enjoy the things I do that are even as simple as walking my own dog and taking doing a Dot Fisher walk or you know, accessing my inner explorer kind of thing and looking closely. But thank you. You can still pitch me on this. Okay.
Could you talk about what you learned about the history of diverse folks enjoying the great outdoors and adventuring? Thanks.
Thank you so much for asking that. I really appreciate it. I was really clear that when I wrote this book that the outdoors has often not been welcoming to a lot of different people, women included, but specifically people of color. I'm sure Sean can speak to this, being like the one of the few, well, you know, on so many levels, you bust stereotypes because you are a grandmother, you're a kindergarten teacher, you're African-American, and you're a woman, and you're a base jumper. So it's you know, as so that's why I actually love starting the book with Shawn, because she actually represents inspiration and this idea that you cannot really do what you cannot see. I think I'm just you cannot be what you cannot see is something that a civil rights activist said, and it's really true. So the history of the outdoors for people of color is really disheartening. I didn't know it. What I knew was that the outdoor retailers did not market to people of color. I was well aware of that because I saw white men, white able-bodied, as Virginia Rose would say, you got to add able-bodied to the thing. So white able-bodied men were often on the cover of almost all magazines that were outdoor or sort of adventure related. And then it was sort of white women, white able-bodied women. And only recently has it been people of color, but it went back way more than that, which is that it's what I could see is there are four big reasons. Is redlining was one of them. So that was when, you know, we did not offer there was no institutional help for people of color financially, no home loans, business loans, that went to white people. So outdoor adventure as a leisure activity, they could afford. And then sundown towns, big reason, because that's when there are towns you could not be caught in if you were a person of color after dark. So what that does is it stops the exploratory mindset that you need to be outside and get outside and get access to places.
Well, and perhaps the most visible recent example is Chris Cooper, who is the black birder in Central Park, and what happened there.
Are they though? Because I just want to say one thing that this was eye-opening to me is that national parks didn't fully desegregate till 1964, which means I was born in 63. That means if my parents had been of color, I would have grown up with people who saw the outdoors too as something that was hostile, dangerous. So my peers of color, no wonder. But there's a sense that people of color are not outside, which is not true. We know that. I know that because I talk to women of color in this book. And there's also a sense they don't want to be. And again, that's the vicious cycle that comes about with, and it's just all not true. And I hope that it changes because the outdoors is for everybody. It really is.
Well, and I'm so happy you introduced this to Shawn and her brave spirit and adventurousness. So do we have there's a question.
I'm curious if you looked into any research or found any differences between outdoor adventure versus games and sports, baseball, soccer, football, tennis, pickleball, you know, anything that, and I don't mean watching it, I mean doing it.
Yeah. Actually, I was interested in that. You know, I went and talked to Miss Kitty, Kitty Weston Nauer. She's the oldest BMX bike racer, female bike racer in the country. And the reason I went is because I thought, what would a competitive sport be like for older women? Must be good, you know, that sort of sharpen our neural pathways with this and give us purpose. And that's all true. But what I found was that I think that there's a bonding that happens when you are in the elements of the outdoors. This is not hard science. This is me throwing in what I've kind of learned. Is there something about outdoor adventure itself? And I would include sports under this because I did interview Miss Kitty. But what I found, it was less the competitive nature and the sort of structure than the outdoors part that adds this bonding and, again, this rebuke to the messaging that we're not strong, for one, and also, but we're not able to deal with uncertainty and danger, which is what the outdoors, like, I don't think pickleball gives you that much uncertainty. It does, and I think it's great, but I think it's a little wider to go. So when I went to interview Miss Kitty about competition, I got totally sidetracked. I also talked to a triathlete called Joan Wicks. She taught herself to run using an app, which was cool. It's called From Couch to 5K. So that was great. And then she, and it really helped her. Running was something that really helped her. And she wanted to do a marathon or a 5K. She wanted to actually compete in a 5K. So she actually joined a group, which she didn't want to do initially because she didn't want to rely on anybody else. And she found that it was the joining of the group that really sparked her further. It kept kind of going for her. The community aspect, in other words, is what surprised her about it. So I would say, yes, it's all under the same rubric, but it's outdoors that's really key.
Thank you. Can you talk more about play and how to encourage it? And particularly, can you encourage it if you're out there by yourself, or do you think you need others in order to encourage it?
You know, there's actually a lot of study on play, and I looked into it. There's lots of kinds of play. There's object play. Does anybody here a play expert? What I was really interested in, frankly, was rough and tumble play, because that's where a lot of bonding happens. And I read about this. When you see like dogs in the park, that's what they're doing, rough and tumble play. And they're not just playing. They're also communicating. They're learning. I would say that a playful attitude is obviously, it's sort of like accessing awe. It's sort of like being present is something that you can get in the outdoors way easier on your own. Of course, it's sort of your attitude. But in terms of where the real power of play happens, I think, so for instance, when I went interviewing the boogie boarders, Lorraine told me that once she got in the water and got hooked, and she thought it was kind of the speed and the vitality and also the confidence she was feeling. So she started doing it on her own. And she told me it didn't quite have the same power as when she did it in community with these other women. And that surprised her. So I think there must be something about play that you do with other people.
Well, I know mountain biking last week after the big rains, it's a lot more fun to laugh about getting all muddy with somebody else. You know, just it is. You got mud up everywhere. And yeah. So,
hi, I'm Marilyn.
Hi.
And
hi,
I'm
Marilyn.
Enjoying every aspect of this. Thank you so much. You mentioned hardware and TSA. Things
I did.
I know about.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, are you a TSA agent?
Oh, no, I have hardware.
Oh, you have a belt. Okay.
A new belt. Do you have any anecdotes that you can share about coming back from injury and how your mindset has helped you come back from injury?
So actually, I hate to talk about my injuries, but I will, because you asked, and I will just say that I did have what am I talking about? I wrote a whole book about one of my injuries. I actually had an accident in my one of my aircraft. And the book is not about injury. But in fact, I tried to sell a book on injury and depression, which it was shocker. It didn't sell. But the funny thing about that is it was about this accident and about, I was intrigued by the mindset that it takes to come back. First of all, how you feel so frail when you've injured just one thing, everything feels frail. But I wanted to write, I thought this would be a really interesting book, but I was under the influence of a lot of Vicodin and depression. But I wrote a proposal and I tried to shop it. But the funny thing was I would tell this story to people and how is this book was going to be. And I was like, blah, blah, blah. And I told them the whole story about injury, depression. And then they told them this one little fact that had happened to me, which is that my cat disappeared during this time. And because I was so crazy, I took it personally. Well, first of all, I was worried that he was dead, of course. But he came back after 5 weeks, and then I took it personally. Because I was laid up on the couch, and I was in this place where I was like, why has my husband cheated on me? Where did you go? And you guys hear me still? Oh, sorry. And so I shattered my ankle, which is why I couldn't walk with Dot. Thank you for saying that with such sympathy. I shattered my ankle. It took me about a year to recover fully, or not even fully. But the big thing about the recovery part was that, anyway, I wrote that book. It's called Lost Cat. It's not about injury and depression. It's about crazy cat people. It's
of which there are
who happened to be on crutches at the time. Yeah. But I want to say that after that injury, I went back to flying, and I found myself being really irritable all the time. And I actually got my instructor to say, let's get me back here because I want to fly again. And I was irritable, and I thought, oh, this isn't fun. So maybe I should never fly again. But I've been flying various things, paragliders, Cessnas, since I was 20. So I thought, well, let me just, obviously what's going on is I'm scared. And that was a little new to me. Also, PTSD. And so what I did was I went and I got hypnotized. And it worked.
Wow.
I was not the same pilot after that, but I was a pilot. And then I fly gyrocopters.
That's interesting.
Really well. I fly gyrocopters.
I'm sorry to say, but the pressing question in my mind, I didn't read your cat book. I'm so sorry. The cat came back.
The cat came back.
Okay, just had to ask.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Hi. Well, I'll say about the cat book is that there was play in that because a GPS wasn't easy to find. So that's like part of the story.
I put a GPS on the cat. Clear you guys. To find out where he went when he was betraying me, when I needed him the most, when I was on my couch.
So I would say that, like, in terms of the depression part, like, that play and curiosity probably helped. But
yeah, probably did. Yeah, no, you're right.
My question was, since you talked to so many people, did you notice if people lived in, you know, where we live in a city, and of course there's a lot of nature around us, but if people were like further away from the city, more in rural places or just places where there's a lot of more nature around, did you notice if
they were better people?
No. If they were more likely to be engaging in these outdoor activities because it was there.
You know, I did not actually, but that's a really good question. I will say that the uniting factor with all these people is they had an exploratory mindset. And so they were able to sort of get outside, even if it was, for instance, with Dot, which was basically a suburban gamble, is what we did. But there is a lot of science, by the way, maybe this isn't directly answering your question, but that the more greenery you're in, the more wild the outdoors is, the better it is for you. I mean, they sort of say like a 5-minute walk in the urban in a park is good, but it's a 5-minute walk, outside the city in a more wilderness is even better. And then there's all statistics on how. And again, it's probably because of all the good things that nature has. The more of that, the better.
So I know you're on book tour, but what's your next outdoor adventure? Is it a walk? Is it some adventure with your dog? What are you doing next?
All that for one, for sure. But I am actually, I have a plan to fly my gyrocopter from Sedona to the Bay Area, back to my hangar, which is cool because I'll be going over Death Valley, the Grand Canyon, and the Sierras. And okay. I'll be really scared a lot of the time, I'm going to tell you.
Well, you are awesome. This has been such an interesting conversation.
Oh, thank you so much.
Her book is amazing. It's available out there to purchase. And thank you so much, Caroline. And thank you, Commonwealth Club. Thank you, Denise.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.